live a very empowered, very supportive life, and we can share with each other in that support, in that building of the new, if we just can allow the old garbage to crash, to disintegrate under our feet, as long as we remain tall in the sovereignty of our divinity of self, we can survive it all. So that's, to me, the meaning of this particular little message that I shared with my guidance. We all have guides, higher selves, future selves, angel spirits, Netheru. We are so deeply connected to nature and to the animal world, to the mineral world. There's guidance, there's communication, there's healing on so many levels for humanity if we only turn our attention to it. So to me, that's an important message to share. We're going to have to move on. Coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. So I invite you to stay tuned for that. And also, I want to remind you that next week, the 21st of September, so I won't be able to speak to you before now and then, we are having our ongoing spiritual support group. It's at Studio Yoga Studio Jnana Yoga on Bond Street, right around the corner from Atlantic Avenue, and we'll be celebrating. We're going to have a ceremony for the energies of the time, which are very, very powerful, and we're going to be using these energies to empower ourselves, our sovereignty, healing, and moving forward in this new age. So if you'd like to join us and you need information, please send an email to heartofmindradio@gmail.com. That's heartofmindradio@gmail.com. We started out with Earth by Michelle Indiocello. We heard Miriam Makeba by West Wind. And now we're going to listen to Emmer Kinney, The Light of You.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, our guest, as has been the case often near September 11th, is Richard Mose. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. A few years ago, there was a documentary released called Not Quite Hollywood about the strange genesis and robust life of exploitation films, Australian-based exploitation films, the genre that gave us Mad Max, Road Warrior, stuff like that. Key among the filmmakers cited was Brian Trenchard-Smith, whose films capitalized on all the expected exploitation elements, baroque violence, gratuitous nudity, and a full-on embrace of a very Australian brand of car culture. But unless you were well-seasoned in sifting through the bins at your video rental shop, or managed to hit HBO on the right night, you were loath to come across his stuff. He didn't quite reach the stature that George Miller did. So that's... I'm Dan Persons, movie review the bins at your video rental shop, or managed to hit HBO on the right night. You were loath to come across his stuff. He didn't quite reach the stature that George Miller did. So that's changing now. There's going to be a Blu-ray release of Trenchard-Smith's Dead End Drive-In next week. I won't say this will change the face of the cinematic landscape, but it is genuine proof that the insanity of exploitation didn't stop at Mel Gibson's steering wheel. Brian Trenchard-Smith, in his audio commentary for the film, amusingly sums up Dead End Drive-In as a cross between Mad Max and The Exterminating Angel. I would throw in Rebel Without a Cause as well, given that it's a tale about a young man struggling to escape from the lot in life society has ordained for him. And by lot, I mean literally, since the film orchestrates its teen protagonist, Krabs, played by a not exactly age-accurate Ned Manning, to be imprisoned in a run-down drive-in theater that the post-apocalyptic government has commandeered as a permanent holding bin for the less useful portions of the youth population. Trenchard Smith himself admits that the setup for this lunatic rewrite of The Great Escape, there's another reference for you, is at best awkward. The first 20 minutes are there basically to get in the obligatory car chase sequences. But once Krabs finds himself incarcerated in a world where restless youth is mollified by day with copious amounts of beer, drugs, and junk food, and by night with backseat sex and endless runs of violent action films, not surprisingly mostly Trenchard Smith's own work, the film becomes a satirical observation of lower-class angst that hasn't particularly lost its relevancy, especially when the government begins siphoning in immigrant Asians and the drive-in's Anglo-Saxon population begins worrying about the distribution of resources. Dead End Drive-In, like the best of Ozploitation, mixes social commentary with inventive, low-budget filmmaking. And by the way, the cinematography by Paul Murphy is great. And it manages to make the war of the classes funny, exciting, and just a little bit touching. If you're looking for something more nuanced, you can stay on the Pacific side of the world and check out The People Garden, which is having a very brief theatrical run, but is also available on demand. It's the tale of a woman, played by Dree Hemingway, who travels to a music video shoot set in a Japanese forest to break up with her rock star boyfriend, only to discover that the philanderer has fled into the woods, otherwise known as a legendary site for suicides. This isn't really a genre film, but director Nadia Litz, who also wrote the script, creates an atmosphere of low-key strangeness, taking her protagonist on a journey that leads her out of her self-involved indignation into a greater understanding of people and the world. The People Garden is more tone poem than full-on drama, but a mysterious and engaging one. I'm Dan Persons. Remember that now is the time when we must make a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
My name is Jim Freund.
I don't even know. Oh, yes, that's the DVD. Well, or rather the CD. Well, we're going to get to that, but not yet. Because before we listen to Richard Bowes on recording, we're going to listen to him live. And let's see if I can figure out what mic you're on.
We do it after the...
Yes, absolutely. But you're on the air now, so we should say good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
There you go. Okay. I don't know how I... I'll be fine once I get my... headphones working. That says guest phones. And yet. So, for those who are unaware, which means that, well, you're among the great many who haven't heard my show through the years, Richard Bowes is... a fairly regular guest on this program and sort of my go-to person when I know I need a quality show and there's no way that I'm going to create one on my own. I get Rick in here and he does that and for us. And this is a good thing because he is a writer of fabulous stature. I don't know exactly how many books you have. Is it about 10?
It's 10 books, yes.
Oh, good. Good six, guess, then.
Six novels and four short story collections. I've published 80 stories at this point, which...
Wow.
I never... Yes, that's what I say. It's completely unexpected. It's very odd... if you've got that many stories, people do keep wanting to reprint them. And it does bring you in a lot of money, but it does bring in a little money.
And prestige, no doubt.
Oh, prestige, Patua. You can't eat prestige. No, it's money.
Oh, yeah, it's an excellent brand. I enjoy their, especially their organic line, yes.
Yes, the vegan prestige, yeah.
Yes.
Yep, that's it.
Oh, okay. pardon me. So about 10 years ago, you published on SciFiction, which was a website edited by Ellen Datlow and was owned in turn by the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi.
So the Sci-Fi channel.
Which I now call the Syphilis Channel because of the way that they respelled and rebranded it. Although it's actually gotten a little better in some ways than it was at the time. And
I still think of them fondly.
You know, well, the way it was overlooked by its owners, Vivendi / NBC, and
that
all
was
that, it really was. In the very year that Sci Fiction won, or at least was nominated for like four major awards, top short stories and novellas being published and all that, I think Ellen Datlow had four stories in 1 year between the Hugos and the Nebulas. And right about the time of the Hugo Awards, they just
pulled the plug
on the whole thing when it was going top guns, you know. It's just weird.
Well, I mourned its loss, but each year at that time, Ellen would wonder whether they would fund for the next year.
Yeah, she was aware of what they were like.
Right, and because for like three or four years in a row they had done this, the fact that they then pulled the plug was shocking.
It really was, yes.
Yes, well, we have some offstage speech.
Yes, well, we were having it, which is why I ran out of the room. Try to quell that sweet whisper. Who wrote that sweet whispers from the wings?
I don't know. I don't.
But it's a wonderful phrase.
It is. I don't know. I don't think. I did.
Oh, okay.
I wrote it.
So, and you're a good writer. So, the what year was it that There's a Hole in the City was first published?
I believe it was 2005, but
I think so.
I believe so, because it was right.
It was about the fifth anniversary of 9/11.
At the end of the trail, also for the Sci-Fi channel there. But
okay, yeah, that's what I wasn't quite sure of.
Yeah.
But I should have figured it out because.
Well, it's one of the things that was very strange. I mean, I'm writing about something that I witnessed a few years before. Everybody sort of did the same thing. There was this sort of pause for a few years. I mean, there were a few things written about 9/11. There were things in the genre that were done. But at a certain
But they were mostly immediate reactions.
Immediate reactions that, in retrospect, probably didn't work. I don't know. You know, it mostly what's in there is what I actually saw, or what I remember is that I saw, with an addition, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the whatever it was, that ship that sank and took all
the General Slocum.
The General Slocum, thank you.
I'm amazed I came up with that.
I'm amazed.
Because I really didn't know enough about that until I became familiar with your story.
So I put those, you know, I included those as prior catastrophes that
I
hadn't witnessed.
Let's not do all the reveals now, since we're going to let people hear the story in a while. And you know what, before we hear the story and before we talk too much about the genesis of it, we each have things that we would like to mention and promote. So why don't we do that first? To start with, from the files of the Galaxy Time Rangers. Cannot say that title without, you know, that Tom Corbett kind of sound.
Tom Corbett, Space Cadet.
Absolutely. Yeah, by now I hope he's gotten a promotion.
I don't.
But 80 years later.
Remember the Bob and Ray thing? It was somebody or other, Interstellar Officer Candidate.
Yes.
I forget his actual name. But Tom Corbett, Space Cadet, it disappeared kind of without a trace.
No. We still have it on VAI. You listen to the Max Schmidt and the Golden Age of Radio. You can hear Tom Corbett.
But you don't get to see the really, really terrible effects. I swear, I remember at some point there was something wrong with the boiler of the spaceship, if you can imagine.
Oh, but you're right.
And it looked like
you're talking about the TV
thing,
version.
And
yeah.
It looked like a plumber's helper just attached to it, and Tom Corbett pulled it off the boiler or whatever.
Yeah, I had a friend. I worked at a talent agency as a clerk, and there was a fellow who was an old hand at live TV, and he was on every show that you can imagine in the early 50s. He'd walk in and say, you know, what am I doing today? They'd hand him the scripts. He might be on two shows that day. It was all live. And one of them was called something like Rocky Jones. Does that ring a bell? It's a science fiction thing, even worse than Tom Corbett. I think it was called Rocky Jones.
What was it? Science fiction.
It was allegedly. Yeah, it was spaceships and stuff like that. And he tells about the time that, and this guy always played the heavy. He had the voice and the girth and all that. Wonderful guy, Earl Hammond, not to be confused with Earl Hamner, who was a producer. Earl Hammond was a wonderful guy. Was doing. I was working, that was at the Lester Lewis Talent Agency, where we handled a lot of voiceover talent, and Myrna Loy. I got to meet, I've told you these stories off the air, Alfred Drake, wonderful, wonderful people that today nobody remembers. They don't remember Alfred Drake, who is one of the great stellar stars of Broadway. Look him up on YouTube and watch Kiss Me, Kate with him and his wife. And that was a Hallmark Hall of Fame version, I believe.
Was that his wife? No, it was Patricia Morrison.
Yes.
Was she his wife?
Yes.
She wasn't when they, she came out.
I thought she was his wife.
Well, she was Hollywood, and she was brought to New York to play the female lead. I don't know.
They may have married after
they fell in love on the on the stage.
I don't know. Maybe that was the case. I had 1 second. Let's ask the phone. Who was Alfred Drake married to?
To whom was Alfred Drake married?
This thing doesn't speak proper English. Well, let's see. We have weird connectivity here. We get better connectivity from the commons on the ground floor than we do from the WBAI server. Sometimes I'm better off turning off the Wi-Fi. Well, never mind. Neither. The point about Earl Hammond was that he told a story about doing this show, and in the middle of the show, for some reason, the cardboard rocket ship in the background just fell over, just in the middle of the, it was a small thing, about, 3 feet high, because it was forced perspective. So the actors are in the front, and this huge, giant rocket ship would be, supposed to be about a quarter of a mile in the distance.
Right.
So you knew it was a towering thing, and just went,
fell down the floor.
I don't remember how he described the ad libs, but they got by somehow.
Well, early television was just full of things like that. You would hear, you'd be listening to, because your grandmother had it on, the Kate Smith Show, which went on for hours every afternoon.
So it was torture.
It was torture, yes. It was. Well, eventually, yes, they were forced under the wartime provisions or something. Anyway, you would hear people talking. At one point, always the television would cease to function. And the picture went off the television in my grandmother's house, and you heard these voices. Now, what the hell is wrong now? Why doesn't the thing? And somebody said, it's the deer up in the Blue Hills that are chewing on the lines.
Yeah. No doubt. So anyhow, if we're going to get to your doing a reading plus our playing the reading that you did, and announcements, we should get to that because, believe it or not, we already have only about 66 minutes left to the show.
All righty, let's do that.
So let me first say that then, okay, next week on this program, if things go according to plan, our guest will be Sunny Moraine, who is a fine horror writer. She is, now people know I'm not the biggest fan of certain kinds of really visceral horror, as Ellen Datlow would call it, body horror. And yet, I really, really enjoy Sunny's work, and she's quite an amazing person and all that good stuff. So she is supposed to be coming here from D.C. next week to do the show. And the week after that, I believe we will have Douglas Cohen here live and John Joseph Adams on the phone talking about a new anthology of theirs, because I think they have one usually weekly. So this will be whatever the latest one is. It's called the Grexit, I think. Is that when you have those little characters, those little cartoon characters that would substitute for a curse word, and could be published in a family newspaper? I believe that word is a Grexit, coined by Mort Walker, I think, one of the great old names in newspaper syndicated comic books. And after that, we're probably, back into our next fund drive for October. But that's what's coming up here over the next 2 weeks. And on November 27th will be our October rendition of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, because the first Tuesday in October is like the second evening of Rosh Hashanah. And the Tuesday after that is Yom Kippur Eve, and believe me, you don't want to run into that. The week after that, the Tuesday would be the evening before the Wednesday of KGB, and we try to make sure that we don't intersect too much, because it becomes a problem for people who want to attend both. And I don't even remember what it is for the fourth week of October. So we're not going to have a reading in October. November 1st, we will have our next reading, and that will be our first Margot Adler memorial reading, named after our own Margot Adler. And that means that it can involve anything vampiric. She was really into vampires. Witches. Journalism, same thing. Any of the many, many things that Margot was into, and the guest curator for that will be Terrence Taylor, who wrote two books that she admired a great deal. So Terrence hasn't booked those people yet. We will find out what that is soon. But September 27th, that's like, 2 weeks from now, not that long. Kai Ashanti Wilson, who is an up-and-coming writer, mostly Tor Books and Tor.com. I'll have the information on his actual materials online tomorrow, and you can you'll see it on Facebook at the NYRSF Readings group or on my page at ourwolf.com, and N.K. Jemisin, who was our guest here just about a mere 2 weeks ago on the show, and going into Lister's show until neither of us could stay awake anymore. But it was a wonderful show. She's a fine, fine writer, and now Hugo Award-winning writer. So that has to be, her name has to be prefaced with that all the time. So Tuesday the 27th, admission is free. donations cajoled, etc. So those are my announcements. And Richard, your latest is a reprint.
The latest is it's a reprint and it'll be out from Letha Press, or at least I hope it will.
Spelled L-E-T-H-E.
Yes, the River of Forgetfulness.
For those not looking at their radios.
Yes. And it was brought out in 2006, and it was on the Nebula shortlist, but did not win the Nebula Award. And I got back the rights to it, and we are in the midst of bringing out a new edition from Letha Press. It's usually when I did this before, when I brought out a new edition of Minions of the Moon, I created a new short story for that.
Yeah, those were the Kevin Grierson stories.
Those were the Kevin Grierson stories, and I created another story that was, I mean, I'll tell you the awful truth, Kevin Grierson was actually me. So for the other, for the new story, basically it was just me, although he had many of the attributes of Kevin Grierson. This one, I'm not going to do that, because this really is the original novel, the first novels that I did. War Child and Goblin Market and, the other one about cancer that I can't remember the name of. Oh, Feral Cell. Those were actual, real, true, through science fiction books. But I don't do that anymore. What I do now is fix-ups, and the fix-ups are really basically about me. And except for From the Files of the Time Rangers.
Yeah, a higher brow way of than fix-up, which you and Cage Baker used, was the Mosaic novel.
The Mosaic novel. Supposedly the thing was invented by Jeff Vandermeer, but he will not accept the
phrase, you mean? Because the concept of it easily goes back to both Phil Dick and Raymond Chandler.
Oh, it goes back.
And probably to Homer.
Oh, it goes back a long, long way. The book made up of stories. The Sportsman's Notebook by Turgenev, basically as a fix-up. Farewell to Arms is a fix-up.
I didn't know that, but it makes perfect sense.
Right, not a complete one, but a couple.
And there are good
writers
who've done stuff too.
Well, no, you know.
I'm sorry, I had to. But yes, a Hemingway dig in there.
What am I talking about here? Oh God. They're all fix-ups. They're all basically I write stories.
In other words, these are interrelated short stories.
These are interrelated.
And you make
stories.
A point as you are writing them to interrelate them so that you can later fix
them
up into a novel.
Use them again and actually try to make
but
some
money out of
it.
But the word mosaic novel is also a legitimate term these things are, interleaving.
Right. This is uninteresting, I think.
I find it fascinating, but now, did you want to read something before?
After, I think.
After you think. Okay. So, by the way, and to make sure that we have enough time, we ought to get to the recording before.
Let's do that.
And mention that this is WBAI in New York City, over 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org through the known and partly unknown universe. And this is, as we were talking about, a story that was written about 5 years after the tower fell, the towers fell. And I like this story the best of the speculative fiction that has been written about that day, about September 11th. Some people have mentioned a story, I don't even recall the title of, by Lucius Shepard, which is also a very good story.
Yes.
But this is my favorite. And I think possibly my favorite of your stories. Certainly within this realm, your fairy tales also hold a lot for me. They're very, I don't know how to describe them, a cross between Kipling and the 17th century salons of France.
The saloons?
Or the saloons, yeah.
Well, the thing about There's a Hole in the City is that it isn't a fix-up. This is it's a long story.
It's a long story that also became the beginning of a collection called Dust Devil.
Devil on a Quiet Street.
On a Quiet Street. We have to push your books, Rick.
We do. Dust Devil on a Quiet Street. You should buy it.
Yes. In print.
In print, yes. In print and begging to be bought.
Yes. Literally.
Story of my life and story of my stories.
And those who are looking for your books, by the way, they go to, your favorite online bookseller or whatever. But the point is that your name is spelled Bowes. Do not look for something spelt like a speaker that one might buy.
No, that is Radio not. I'm sorry to say that I do not have anything to do with the Bowes system. But yes, go buy them from Amazon and buy them from Barnes
Powell
and Noble
Books
and yes, anybody who will sell them to you.
Yes, and most will.
You will be so glad that you did.
Actually,
you will. Yes.
So
but
should
I
we,
will be even gladder.
So should we with that proceed?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a recording that we made when BAI was still at 120 Wall Street late one night. We did this basically in about a three-hour session after a meeting at WOHOP. And it's always good to have a meeting at WOHOP and then do whatever you like, or do whatever you like and then have a meeting at WOHOP. I'm always, I'm flexible that way. But we were able to walk from WOHOP to the radio station, which, being here in Brooklyn, we can't do today. Well, actually, you could, but walking the bridge at night
is not advisable.
It really isn't. Although, during the day, probably be, about a 45-minute walk? Could be done.
Probably it would. Let's play the...
So, we will in a moment, yes. Let's just say that I was very happy with the resulting program. We're going to hear, I believe actually we're going to cut into myself introducing it from a CD that was produced here at WBAI for promotional purposes, where we had also matched you up on the 10th anniversary with a psychologist by the name of Dr. Charles Strozier. And that whole thing may very well be available next Thon. Who knows? At any rate, let's get to the story.
About Richard and Dr. Charles B. Strozier, who will be coming in after the
how redundant
is over
am I, huh?
to discuss this, and we will talk about the short story. But at this time, we're going to begin that story on such a very special day.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes, Wednesday, 9/12/01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly, but the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd,
ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho, people who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' face faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. "Couldn't sleep much last night," I said. "Because of the quiet," she said. "No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice." I said, "Notice how, with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies. Like 1965 all over again." She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a run-down building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he'd made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's Ancient Airs and Dances played. "Like the Blitz," someone said. "Never the same again," said a person at another table. "There isn't even any place to volunteer to help," a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. "Mrs. Pirelli," I said, "the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames on television. Her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death." Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot in his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone.
And you woke up?
No, I tried to call you. But the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that. But Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. There's a hole in the city, said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed watching but not seeing some old movie on TV, avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. Cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second-floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged. "Anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said good night, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV set up in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who'd made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Thursday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, "Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it." "Hi, Mags," I said. "You want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall, normally used by faculty, on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown open its cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive-green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now. It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it." "Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in?" It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. "There are others," she said. "Kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village." "Jesus," I said. "Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't." This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. "He'll want to find us," she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she had been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, bit of a little wise-ass, who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. "How's it going?" "It sucks. My stuff is all downtown where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, Bic razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned, and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me." He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. "Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please?" So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed and a squad car with its roof crushed were hauled up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich villagers gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it, for the first time, the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. "If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it?" He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here." I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw in Astor Place," she said, her voice clear and crazed, "the ones all burned and drowned? They were on the General Slocum when it caught fire." "Kid you saw and asked a place all burned and drowned," I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. "On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes." The connection started to dissolve into static. "Where are you, Mags?" "Ground Zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet?" she shouted into her phone. "Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here." At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. "Mags, give me your number. Call me back," I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. "She saw those kids? I saw them, too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night." "You talked to the counselors?" I asked. He drained the bottle. "Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy, you understand." The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. "The Air Force," I said, "making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit." "Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff?" So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. "Okay," he said. "You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff?" When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown in the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got to talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, "There isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats." I murmured, "He's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin." "Or eating his yappy dog," said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the East and West villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, "This is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep." I left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently. That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid who'd also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue, last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, the email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle and a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station was open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street in the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself," and none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white, and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact," and Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the Army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivor's party. In the days of the French Revolution, the Terror, that's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On Sixth Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped. "Here comes the bride," leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of Sixth Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black-and-white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street. I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back, but the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across Sixth, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank-you note on the fridge, signed by all three kids, and I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about, bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we three had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him, and he disappeared. I looked aside, and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, "And even after." And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me. Three sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mags' building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang the super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mags. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened, and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9-23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9-11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. "Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to," he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. "Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions," I said to Roger. "Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell?" As he said that, flames sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her!" Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. "Was that them?" Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. "Be smarter than we were," I said, and Marco said, "Sure," with all the confidence in the world.
Oh, Well, I'm sorry the story is over, because we are having a wonderful conversation here, because we've both heard it. But this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Rick Bowes, Richard Bowes, who you just heard reading his short story from 10 years ago, There's a Hole in the City. And we broadcast that on the 10th anniversary at 11 a.m. And it was an amazing, magical thing that we tried to get to the radio station, which at the time was at 120 Wall Street. And, of course, that's about five blocks from Ground Zero.
Place like I have never seen.
Yeah, and there were a president or three there, and undignitaries of various kinds.
Guys with rifles on the roofs.
Absolutely. There were all kinds of military things going on. We had to walk approximately half a mile. Yeah. They would not allow private cars, anything but military jeeps, to get near the area. Yeah, and limos, of course, often with motorcades. And we walked to the radio station, and we got there only to find our station manager, Berthold, and program director Tony Bates, and Kathy Davis, who was on the air just before us, Catherine Davis now. And we were off the air. And there were some transmitter problems, phone line issues, whatever they may be, for a change. Not that we hadn't paid the line, it was a technical issue. And about two minutes before broadcast, we were all ready not to broadcast, the problems resolved themselves. And lo and behold, we were able to run that broadcast, and it was quite magical. So this is, in a way, the third, quintennial anniversary. There's the event itself. Yep. The story hadn't been written. We broadcast it about 5 years, not long after it had been published in Sci Fiction by Ellen Datlow. Yeah. And this is now, we've broadcast a few times since, but this is the 15th anniversary broadcast, not of the broadcast, but 15th anniversary of the event that incited the broadcast, even though the story's about so much more than 9/11.
I am amazed in hearing it again. The story was a popular story, and yet so much of what is in there, I mean, the narrator is gay. The narrator is a former drug addict.
The narrator is you.
The narrator is me, yes. Right, but I...
Let's just cut to the quick here, Rick.
And he's in a menage a trois. And, you know, it's not, or was, it's... not exactly. He's not exactly, you know, the sort of character you would think would become the main character in a popular story. I was considerably heartened by this. It was long enough ago that to be, I mean, in one way, if you were an out gay author, people wanted to have one. We need a faggot for the issue. You know, we need to have a gay person. That worked, but there was also discrimination. There were people who weren't at all happy about this within the genre itself. And yet for this story, that didn't apply. The story X'd everything. In that way, I'm continually surprised.
It's a brilliant story. Plain and simple. People who don't, if you, the listener, are not familiar with Rick's work, this is a great entry.
And if, yes, listen to it. If you can listen to it here from WBAI, it's on, you can read it out out of John Adams. I forget if it's Lightspeed or the other one has it.
No, it's not Nightmare Magazine. It's Lightspeed.
Is it Lightspeed
it's
itself?
It's at Lightspeed.
I can never remember.
And it's, well, since I work for them,
yes,
I have to know this stuff. And I'm an audio editor for them, I should explain. I have no editorial control, even though the word people get confused because they hear that I am, my title is podcast editor. Well, I don't choose the story. Stephen Rudnicki does
you
that.
You edit them.
I do the audio editing, right. And I'm the host.
Well, editor is a word that is, it's...
Multifaceted.
Yes. It means to many people whatever it is they want to have it. But yeah, no.
We need to mention what you have, because we have really very little time left. So,
well, I was going to...
You're not going to be able to read, I don't think, unless it's very brief.
Well, I will just talk about it. The story is basically centers on this kid who has been... It's come out in high school in 1984 that he's gay. And this is not good. He is attacked. He is stripped and left on the front lawn of the school. He is taken back to his house by his stepmother. He is all physically screwed up. He goes down to the cellar that night. His father, who is never around, never supportive, sees him very rarely, is not around. He goes, but the father has a gun kept in a box downstairs in the cellar. He gets that. He is... goes out of the house late at night. He is going to shoot the ringleader of the kids who did him in. He's going to wait until he comes out the door. He falls because he's taken some painkillers. He falls asleep. He wakes up. His father is there out of nowhere. And he helps the kid up. He takes him into the woods that around and examines him, makes sure he's not hurt. He says, I failed you, and not for the first time. And then, because this is a time ranger story, and the kid has no idea of time rangers, the father leads me to the shelter of the woods, and he said there was a saying when I was in the Army, go west, young man, and grow up with your country, or at least find a spot where the law back home can't locate you, and the law where you are doesn't give a damn. I'm bringing you to such a place. He takes the kid down this hole. There are these runs that exist in the world in which you can travel. Woods and houses, open waters and mountains appeared. We traveled under the jet stream of planes that flew above us. We sat down at a monastery on a rocky coast. The monks nodded to my father, shared their soup and bread. We went down stone steps into a cave where a small engine waited on tracks. We rowed that out to a coast where powerboats waited on a long wharf. We flew over endless water, got carried along by traffic on highways and past gray stone cities. All the while he held me. Then we were on a lush lawn, and what I later learned was a lost fragment of 18th century Italy. On a rise stood a statue of Apollo wearing only a lyre. That's the kind of god for you, my father said.
Who mourns for Adonis? I've still got the Star Trek anniversary in my head, so I'm just imagining that.
I tried to give a sample of what the story was like, and I tried to give a sample of what the book is like.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book.
And in this,
I don't think I've seen the new cover. I remember the John Picaccio cover.
John Picaccio cover was a great cover. I have, I think, a better one. Chris Dykman is helping me with this.
Well, she's always...
She's amazing. And
she did the logo for Hour of the Wolf. And
she did... guy's name is David Batista. He's a photographer.
It's a familiar name.
It is a familiar name. He's around. He does write an occasional spec fiction story, but mainly he does photography. And he did photographs for us for the front cover. There's so many god statues in New York. And that's what's going to be on the
front cover. Fabulous.
And that has...
People, you have to not go by the title. The title is simply... a titillation kind of thing.
You got to call it something.
You got to call it something, but it's not pulp fiction, which is what the title sort of implies.
Right, and it is like
all of it, it is made up of short stories. But in this case, they're not about me.
They're a bit more mercurial,
so to speak.
Little pun there, folks.
Little pun, yeah. The gods.
Because it's mostly Roman gods.
It is mostly Roman, Greco-Roman gods, yeah.
Greco, okay. From that pantheon.
Mostly,
yeah.
And I kept wondering, should I put in other gods? And I think, no, there are more than enough gods. There's also politics in it. There's something that's not unlike the Kennedy family is in there. Mm-hmm. And I think it deserved more attention than it got.
It got some attention.
Well, it was a Nebula nominee.
Exactly. You know, that's
but
pretty
I did
darn
that
good.
Through chicanery and cheating. I thought
No. You won an award for There's a Hole in the City through chicanery and cheating, and I betted and aided you on that.
That was
one.
Only one of the awards, but yeah, that was the one. That was a Million Writers thing.
That was a Million Writers South Award, which was a popular vote award where all you had to do was go online to a website and click something.
Yes.
And I went on the air and said, everybody listening, I want you to go. And it worked.
It worked. The
you
next
won by a landslide because the ballot box had been fixed in previous years by friends of a particular person on a campus or something like that. And so we fixed it. I believe this is before I knew I was diabetic. I charged you a bar of chocolate those services because you don't take bribery easily. And about a year later at ReaderCon, Kat Valenti comes up to me with a bar of chocolate and says, I understand that you can be had for a piece of chocolate. And, you know, first of all, her phraseology was rather interesting. But after that, I learned. And lo and behold, the evil magic worked twice. And that was the last time, thank God. Well, also, in following years after that, you and she were the only speculative fiction candidates in a field of largely dull, bad mainstream, non-genre stuff. And then, like, the following year, everything was spec fic, and I knew, like, 3 out of the 5 nominees. And then I, like, no, sorry. No fixing this one.
Now it's back. It's very few science fiction. I was a judge in them.
That's right.
For several years, and I specialized in spec fiction writers. The last year in which I was a judge, there were almost no spec fiction stories.
Really?
And I don't know what that's going to be. I don't know if they're still going to have me as a judge. But
We are horrifyingly out of time.
Oh, sorry.
So am I. So the books in print now are from the files of the Galaxy Time Rangers.
From the files of the Time Rangers.
I throw in Galaxy because it feels like it belongs.
I'm not sure that is in print. It will be.
But it will be very shortly.
The ones that you can buy with your money, which I encourage you to do, is Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, which is basically me in Greenwich Village.
And that includes There's a Hole in the City.
That does include There's a Hole in the City, which is Greenwich Village. And Minions of the Moon, which is the story of my life. And, they're all the story of my life.
There's the Aqueduct Press book.
I was going to say, it's a collection of fairy tales.
Brilliant
stuff. The Queen, the Cambion, and 7 Others, which is my favorite book. And there is another collection called If Angels Fight. It's a short story collection. Those are all available. There are also the 3 early books, War Child, Goblin Market, and Feral Cell, can be had at fairly reasonable prices.
Yeah, and if people go to your website, they can find out more about this.
There's no website anymore.
You're kidding me.
No, I know.
I built that website for you. Chris Dykman took it over. This is not right.
It is not, but...
Do you still have the URL?
Probably.
Well, maybe we have to do something about that.
I guess we do.
At any rate, I will be back next week with Sonny Moraine. Rick will be back here soon enough, I hope. And perhaps, when are the Time Rangers coming out, if you'll pardon the expression?
It will either be very late this year or the beginning of next year.
So by that time, we will have you back just for that event.
Yes.
And then you can read from that story.
By that time, the story will actually be finished.
Ah, how about that? In the meantime, everybody, have a good week. Be good to each other because we deserve it and you deserve it. And
be as unique as you can.
And be as unique as be very unique. And the entirely unique Sonny Moraine will be our guest next week. Thanks for listening. Take good care. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister, who is, thank God, back from storming in the Carolinas. Good morning and take care. Oh, yeah, visit the Hour of the Wolf group in Facebook and OurWolf.com. And hope to see you November 27th here at 388 Atlantic Avenue.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to spit it. I am a
fullitarian. I am. Red, white, and blue. I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong. Causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Tanzania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. nice and easy. Rock me nice and slow. In the early morning, how you turn me on? So let the good times roll. Set them try fi separate. Me no wanna crack fi smoke. Give me the eyeball in my brain. I let it light up in my door.
99 Cinco Lista Live. Celebrating the birthday of Lista's mother right here. 99 Cinco, Nancy Jonah. Happy birthday to you. The entire show is dedicated to you and Ted Bafalufos, who just died, passed away, leaving Eugenie Bafalufos in Greece. The movie maker Ted Bafalufos passed away 10th of September. So sad. So we're going to hit it from the top and dedicate the entire show to Ted Bafalufos, filmmaker of Rockers, and a happy birthday girl, Nancy Jonah. Chronics, Trevor Dyer in California, A. Scotty in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah, here we go.
Rock me nice and easy. Rock me nice and slow.
Australia.
Yo,
New Zealand. Here we go, y'all.
Set them try fi separate. Me no wanna crack fi smoke.
Globalizing the burning of impurities, red, white, and blue in impurities, USA. Yeah, yeah.
I know me yellow one, steaming the sense every time. If not be look at the ital steamers and a chill up. This will make a second land season of a sit down. Upon the cold concrete, you have a lead down.